I think it's bad news for the English game.
We're not creative enough, and we're not positive enough.
It's coming home, it's coming home, it's coming, football's coming home.
We'll go on getting back, so I'm getting back, so I'm getting back, so I'm getting back.
It's coming, football's coming home, it's coming.
Evening, one and all. Well, that fooled you, didn't it? Not our normal introduction, but relevant today because I was just telling my guest about this. European soccer tournament semi-final. England beat Netherlands and are into the finals. Now, that's a long while since, in soccer-wise, we were in the finals of the things. Goes right back. The last time we won anything was, in fact, we, as in England, I'm talking, by the way, was in 1966. Well, 1966, I was 13, 14, round about then. And, of course, we had, it was a big thing to actually have a sort of world tournament like this, like the Soccer World Cup at that time. And I remember distinctly we had a little black A40 car, family car, and Austin A40, and we had a little World Cup Willy was the mascot, a lion. World Cup Willy was the mascot, and we had a little sticker in the car, and people were laughing and everything. Yeah, well, England won't do very well. Of course, we won it. And since that time, as the song said, you know, it's coming home. In other, we've been waiting for the next victory to come along. And hopefully, though we put Spain have been playing very well, we play Spain in the final on Sunday. You know, you never know, we might do it. Now, why I brought that up relevant to my guest today is to show, you know, to go through this sort of thing about getting old, about the fact now, here I am in my 70s, and every day nearly a star, a sports star, a musician, somebody like that, that I was raised with as a hero, or I knew, or anything like that, passes from this world. And it's a hard life. What used to be, you know, we used to go out sort of family weddings and stuff like that. These days, it's nearly all family funerals. It's a hard thing to do, to sort of suddenly realise, hey, old age catches up with you. And it does. And suddenly, you know, you can't, you drop things, you can't bend down, you can't do this, and you want to try and do it. You don't know what's happened. Life has changed suddenly. But it's not just for you, it's for those around you. My guest today, she can tell us a bit about this because she's written a great book that covers this. But I better introduce her, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only Rebecca Sugar. Hi, Rebecca. How are you doing?
Hi, Barry. I have to say, that's the... I've done podcasts. I've never been introduced by way of a conversation about British soccer before. That's a complete first for me. Well, very well done.
Well, it's just relevant because, you know, here, as I said, 1966, the last time. Now, obviously, we've had lots of other things in other sports, you know, the Olympics and everything like that in that sort of time. But when it comes to just soccer, we've got there close, we've sort of lost on penalties, we've done everything. But 1966, and everybody still says about it, that 66 is the year in England. And that song by the Lightning Trees called Coming Home, that was from the 70s, and it's still brought out every time we talk, it's still singing it today. That and Vindaloo was another one that they sort of brought, you know, football type song that they're bringing out. And people are sort of sitting there saying, finally, don't tell me we could win something after all this time. And life's gone by. It's a wink of an eye. Suddenly, you're still talking about it as if it was last year or yesterday. And it's 50, 60 years ago. It's crazy, but it's... Yeah, I thought it was sort of relevant a bit to your great book. But let's talk about you first, because you are known. Well, you're no, I mean, you've written for lots of papers and stuff like that, and the Jewish Chronicle, and you know, Spectator and stuff like that. But you are the cocktail party contrarian. Yeah. Now, not reading the New York Sun, I don't know who that is, but that is you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the name of my column at the New York Sun, where I've been writing since it relaunched a couple of years ago. Yeah, I write about sort of socio-political, socio-cultural issues, and my friends always told me that I always seem to have a contrarian view about everything. So I figured, okay, why not put it in print? And, you know, I'm that girl at the cocktail party when everybody says X, I tend to say, no, how about Y?
Oh, crikey, you don't want to be the same as everybody else. I mean, if everybody thought the same and did the same, what a boring place this would be.
That's right. I'm sure everybody really appreciates how not boring I am when I'm doing my contrarian thing.
I mean, is that a weekly, bi-weekly? What sort of...
Every other week, I write the column for them. And then I've written other pieces for the Wall Street Journal and for, as you said, The Spectator, which was a lot of fun for me to do, and USA Today and some Jewish publications and the Christian Post, just other publications whenever they'll have me.
Okay, that's great. Now, like a few other people we've had on the show and a lot of people who did it during that time, of course, it was when we were all under lockdown. Was that what finally pushed you to do, to writing something a bit longer?
Yeah, I guess I did, initially I didn't really set out to write a book, but it was COVID and, my kids were sort of, fortunately, I have twins, and at the time they were about, I guess, 13. So they were old enough to do Zoom school on their own without me having to hover over them, but young enough to still be home and sort of polite and happy and good on their own, and they had each other. So I had a lot of time on my hands when I wasn't, changing the bed sheets and trying to make dinner. And I think I was just sort of, I just started typing because I write anyway, and it's a way to express myself. And about 30 pages of what I thought was just sort of rambling diary entries kind of came out. And I didn't really touch it again for a couple of months. And then I sort of woke up one night, in the middle of the night, and I literally from that moment just wrote for weeks until it was just all done. Or at least the pre-edited version was done. And I sort of thought, is this a book? So that's sort of how it happened. It was not deliberate at all.
Now, I know you relate what the book's about a bit to a Leonard Cohen song. Now, was that a case of that song? Because I know myself writing and other people, when you're writing a book, sometimes you've got this song going round and round in your head, or other people have a set load of songs that they write to and stuff like that. Or was it a case of after you finished the book, you suddenly thought, that reminds me, that Leonard Cohen song is a bit relating to this. How did the song get in your mind related to the book?
Yeah, so the book, right, is called Everything is a Little Broken, and the Leonard Cohen song, the lines in it are, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. I did think of that quote while I was writing the book, but the initial title of the book, I was just going to call it The Decline, the story of a woman whose father, elderly father, is in, a certain stage of physical decline in his, senior years, and she's watching that happen and how heartbreaking it is for her. But I was going to call it The Decline, and my publisher, sort of said, that is such a depressing title. Did you think of something else? So I was like, yeah, that's true. It's a pretty depressing title. So I guess inspired by that quote, I didn't want to steal his words exactly, but yeah, Everything is a Little Broken was sort of a riff on Leonard Cohen's idea, and this idea that the book is about a solemn and sort of sad subject on the one hand, but I try to infuse it with humor because I don't want it to just be, some weepy, tear-jerking kind of thing. When I was finally thinking about making this into a book and looking around at what else was out there on the subject, there's a lot of really good self-help stuff, good peer-to-peer information for caregivers. There's all sorts of things, but there wasn't a lot that sort of poked a little fun at it and could make you laugh and cry at the same time. So there had to be light that also got in, otherwise I don't think I could have told the story. And a lot of it's autobiographical woven into a fiction story. So, I told it a little bit reflecting how I experienced my father's sort of physical condition now. He's in his 80s. He's had a physical condition for a very long time, and it only gets worse as you get older. And we deal with it with, humor, not laugh out loud, belly laugh humor, but but kind of a wink and a nod at life's absurdity and how fragile we all are and how ridiculous the human body is, and trying to kind of, you know, make jokes at the least funny moments to kind of restore a little bit of humanity and dignity in some very tough times.
And that's one of the things, you know, the sort of dignity part. My own father, I remember him going, he had Parkinson's, which went into dementia. Mm. And I, especially sort of at the time, the latter part of his life, I was over here in America and sort of going back. And I remember going back one time and he'd actually was in hospital at that time. And I said to my mother, I said, does he know it's me? I said, no. Mm. And she said, yeah, well, one of my nieces would not go and see him. She said, "That's not Gramps. That's not Gramps. That's a shell. There's, you know." I said, "Well, he's in there somewhere." And when I said goodbye to him, even though he didn't know what was going on, he still knew it was me saying, you know, goodbye to him, which turned out was the last time I saw him alive, sort of thing. But you go through that. And you, as you say, the laughter and stuff like that. And I know we did with him, with the stuff he went through. And he always had a very good sense of humour, and he sort of joined in. And that, though he sometimes obviously didn't know what he was laughing at, but after going through that, I now find that I'm that person. You know what I mean? You know, and I'm thinking, oh crikey, well I can remember this, but then you know, and things that really. Stupid things that really annoy me. The fact that I've done sport all my life and I've always been known to have, you know, a good safe pair of hands for catching and stuff like that. And now I'm dropping everything. You know, I get so upset with myself, and it's not the face, just in case I'm dropping the thing, I can't bend down to pick it up. You know, I have to have these grabbers everywhere around the house, you know. But I'm sort of laughing. I start having a right go at myself, you know, you stupid idiot, you dropped that. But and then I think, well, hang on, you went through I went through this type with my dad, and now it's me, and it's very hard to come to grips with stuff like that. But if you, like we've done this book, have got this with the humour and that and the story, it does so much more when people read it, I think, as a fictional book than the sort of 20 ways to make things better type things, because people automatically put themselves or their family, people, you know, loved ones, in that position in the story. It doesn't say a name, but that's what I think. And I always think it's a lot better, whether it's an illness, whether it's, you know, through some terrible trauma in their lives or abuse or something like that. If it's in a story, people put themselves in that and can relate to it rather than just the do's and don'ts.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I also I have one very particular experience of this with my father. You know, he's mentally 100%, but physically, you know, 10%. So that's one form of aging that some people go through with their parents. And then there are people, you know, who have parents with dementia and people who have parents with, you know, who have all sorts of other, you know, physical issues that don't affect their mobility, but might affect, you know, their eyesight or their hair, all kinds of scenarios that my friends have sort of talked about. So I try to weave as many of them into this story as I could, and telling it as a fiction novel helped me to do that. And I wanted to try to expand it beyond my own personal experience. But, you know, in every case, I think I'm 53, and I'm beginning to feel a little bit of what you were saying. You know, sometimes I get out of a chair and my lower back hurts, and I've never had a back issue in my life. And I think I laugh because, you know, we're all headed somewhat in the same direction. We're all, it's a spectrum, and hopefully, you know, you come out on the easier end of it. Some people get luckier than others, but you know, nobody's body is brimming with energy and you know, buoyancy at 102. Nobody that I've ever met.
Right.
So we all have our things, you know, as we get older and we start to realize more and more what our parents have gone through. And you have to laugh because ultimately we're also frail. The human body is miraculous. It's also frail at the same time. And it is sort of ridiculous. Like, I look at my 17-year-old kids and I think, yeah, you're going to have to, like, put me in your pocket and carry me around one day.
Yeah,
like, I'm trying to help my dad out of his chair.
Exactly. Do you ever look back?
It's a universal experience.
Do you ever look with your children? Do you ever look back and see them and think of things your parents said to you? Because my mother said, when I was younger, my mother said, I can't wait till you get married so I can come to your house and start running up and down your stairs. I think with my kids, stop running up and down the stairs. You know, that's what I was told. Yeah.
That's very funny. Yeah, you know, we all turn into our parents a little bit, I guess.
And,
you know, what I think has been really special and important for me is, like, my kids have spent a lot of time with my parents. They live about an hour away from us. As my kids were growing up, we would go there every Friday night and every Saturday. And so, you know, they don't even need that generational sort of inheritance. Like, they know all the things that my father and mother say, and they kind of see it pouring through me to them, and they have a real relationship there, which has really been very important to me.
Very special. Very special indeed. Unfortunately, because of circumstances and distances, you know, my children haven't got that. Well, no, they haven't really got that. But, you know, I was sitting down talking to my wife. We were talking the other day. And so, you know, you realize I'm number two on my family now, age-wise. And the only person older than me is my mother that's still alive. She's, God bless her, is 95 and 96, getting her around, still driving, still and everything. But, you know, I'm number two. I'm the eldest male in my family line. And she says, well, you know, I'm number three, she said. You know, and when I first met her, say 15, 20 years ago, you know, there was aunts and uncles coming out of the furniture. You know, it was but it's how it goes. Now, I know in your book, Everything Is a Little Broken, you cover this, Myra, is it? And Myra, her father's declining in years and stuff like that. But she's also got issues, isn't she, with a grandmother or something it's not good?
There's an older character in the book who's actually also based off of my real life, a woman named May in the book, who was the nanny of father, Matt.
Right.
And also Mira's nanny. And that was true in my life, too. My father grew up with a woman who worked in the home, was his nanny, technically, and the housekeeper. And she then came and worked for him when he was an adult and had a family and was my nanny and housekeeper. So she was in our family for about 70 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I say the words nanny and housekeeper, but she was like a mother to me, and we loved her. She was part of the family. I hardly knew that she was not the family, you know.
Oh, yeah.
She lived with us most of the week. So she, in the book, May, is much older and dying, basically. Mm-hmm. And she is a Pentecostal Christian, a very devout religious woman. Matt, Mira's father, is a sort of traditional Jewish man. And they are sort of soulmates, the two of them, May and Matt. And they come from completely different worlds, but they have a shared language of faith and shared memories, right? A whole history. And it sort of becomes clear. And Mira in the book also is quite close to May and adores her and tends to her as she's sort of fading away, and recognizes sort of what you just said, you know, that the repository of the family history and memory for 70 years is leaving.
Yeah.
All of her memories of Matt when he was young and healthy and could run up and down a flight of stairs and carry heavy things, which Mira has never known her father to do. All of that is leaving. And Mira recognizes now she's, as you said, the number two slot. Her parents are there, and then it's her, and she's looking at her daughter and saying, you know, I'm going to be that person soon. It's a moment of real recognition about life cycle and generations and loss and memory.
One of the interesting things over the last sort of 4 or 5 years I've seen is the increase in the number of people writing sort of family stories, writing, you know, letters from the war and stuff like that into books, because the passing down from generation to generation, these stories that were always sort of family, just doesn't happen these days. There's no sort of everybody gathering around the sink doing the dishes and being told a story of when their grandmother was growing up with, you know, no shoes and all this. It doesn't happen anymore. People are out doing, you know, working. And I think that's a great thing. While these people are actually being able to gather this information and share these stories with so many people who read the books.
Yeah, and I think it's also intergenerationally really important, because, right, especially in this situation, like when you're watching your, in my case, let's say my father had a chiropractic injury when he was 40, and his life really physically was never the same. He was never physically able to do much. And now in his older age, he's really very limited in his mobility. But so even though he was very functional, let's say, when I was young and growing up, and he could travel and he worked every day in an office, but, you know, getting in and out of cars was hard and he couldn't exercise. I never saw him play a game of tennis and all that.
Yeah.
And so I have a view of my family, my parents, from this sort of childlike perspective. We all do. But there was a whole life he had before me. And stories about him when he did play tennis and he did do all those things I can't even imagine, that the older generation above him, in this case, in the story, May, in real life, her name was Ella, she had all those memories of him. So sitting around and telling those stories is such a treasure trove also, because you experience the older generation through the eyes of people who knew a whole other side of them. And you learn about your parents, you know, things that sometimes you find hard to believe because you didn't have that experience of them yourself. So, telling these stories is really, really important. And it's also, you know, the world in which they grew up, so vastly different. It was a pre-technology kind of era, that, you know, the stories are just unique at this point. My kids sometimes can't understand how my father, you know, could, like, not have had a television until he was, you know, 6 or 7 years old, or, you know, how did you call people when you were in the car? I mean, just it's great to have those stories and have them passed down.
It worries me. I have concern is that whereas, yourself and these sort of people know that they've got to look after the elder generation and been brought up with that. Look at some of the teens and stuff like that these days. They have no idea to do anything like that. They have no idea. You know, you ask them. I was at baseball on Monday, and when they get like a hot dog and a drink and stuff like that, and the till wasn't working, and it was a case of $6 and $3 taken away from $20, right? And the till's not working. Hang on, I've got to get my phone out to see how much change I've got to give you. And then she got it wrong. Then she got it wrong. And I said no. And I tried to explain, but they just haven't. You know, they. When I grew up, we used to be in my later teens and stuff like that. Used to play darts a lot down the pub and stuff like that. Now, when you play darts, the winner, it used to be people's there, and the winner stayed on, and then the next person up used to chalk the game, you know, do the scores on the chalkboard. None of this calculator stuff, it's chalkboard, you know. If you were no good at chalking, if you couldn't mentally do the scores and stuff like that, you'd never get a game, you know. So you're used to mental arithmetic was part of your life. You did it. You took things away automatically or what have you. Now it's, if I've got, I take the phone out, look at it, do the calculator, you know, what's such and such. I got to check on Google sort of. That's what that means. And so I'm really concerned for the future, because they haven't got the. I don't know how to put this nicely. some of them just haven't got the common sense, you know, to do stuff if they're not spoon fed it. And that being the case, how are they going to look after, you know, the older people? They're not. They're just going to stick them in a home or something, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, people often ask me about sort of what I think you know, policy recommendations would be for the elderly. And now that people are getting older and older, right? You know, my father's father died in his 60s. You know, this is a whole new thing to have people living into their 90s. It's never really happened before. And so, you know, what should policies be to address this and all this? And I'm not a policy expert. I just wrote a book, you know, a fiction novel. But I always say, like, family is the best policy prescription for old age. You know, if you have to put somebody in a home, I understand. But, you know, nothing substitutes for family being around. And sometimes it is a bit of a burden, and sometimes it is hard, and sometimes there are disconnects. Sometimes the younger generation doesn't understand the older generation, which may be why it's even more important for them to be around and to help. And, you know, because it's not just about taking care of their physical needs, right? I mean, my father, we're fortunate. My father has an aide who can lift him out of a chair or help him take a shower. I mean, plenty of people have to do that on their own.
And exactly. It's simple things, and people... and this is why I'm sure your Everything Is a Little Broken, your book, is going to be a great help to a lot of people, because it covers that sort of thing that other books just don't do. And the fact it covers with a bit of humour and stuff like that, a lot of people are, I'm sure, going to sort of find help from it. What sort of response have you had so far?
I hope so, yeah. Well, it's been really interesting, right? I mean, certainly amongst my circle of friends, nobody tells the truth. They just say, we love it, we love it. But no, in all honesty, you know, you get a lot of what's been most interesting for me is talking to people on, like, caregiver podcasts and caregiver groups, people who really are going through it. And they have such vastly different experiences of it. And it can be really hard. There are people who really have no help at all and have to do it all themselves. And it's just all very hard, but the thread through seems to always be, even in its worst moments, it's a privilege if you get to care for your parents in their old age, even if it takes a big bite out of you, and it does. I think there's something like 41 million Americans who are caring for an older parent someone with a handicap in their home. And, you know, a lot of them work full-time jobs and raise kids, and they have to, you know, work remotely because they have to be home and they don't have anybody to take their mother into the shower. It's super hard, but even then they still feel that it's a privilege to be able to do it for their children, to see them doing it and to, as much as they can, you know, provide not just the physical needs of the parent, but the emotional support. That's equally important, that their mental state remains high and positive, and that they know they're loved, and that they know they're still valued and needed, and they're not just a burden on the family, that their advice and their stories and their wisdom is valued. All those things matter, and no one can provide that like family.
Indeed, and what's been a great value to us is actually having you as a guest on the show, but time is whizzing by, as it always does when we have such a good chat. So what I'm going to do now, Rebecca, is actually hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about yourself and, of course, your book.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, so Everything Is a Little Broken is available on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com. And I have a website called RebeccaSugarOnline.com where you can read a bit about the book, and you can read all my articles. And that's where you can find me.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today. And good luck with Everything Is a Little Broken. Great book. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Well, there you go. My guest today, Rebecca Sugar, talking about her book. As I said, Everything Is a Little Broken. Sure, a lot of people can relate to it, and a lot of people, I'm sure, will learn from it as well, because that's all part and parcel of it. You never know until you've been there. But I'll be back on Sunday between 5 and 6 p.m. Eastern with Those Are the Days, music from the 20th century, where we get a theme and we play all room music around that theme. I don't know what we got this week. I haven't done it yet, that's why. And then after that, between 6 and 7 p.m., we have music from the 60s in the swinging 60s. That's not just for the British invasion, it's music from around the world. And then next Tuesday and Wednesday, I'll be back here with a couple more book and a chat guests. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...
Blow away the cobwebs and stop yawning. A little cup and sorcery is magic in the morning.
are in the evening too. Cheese up, pour yourself a cup, tickety-boo.